Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Freedom!
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth, and co-host Christopher John O'Shea is with me. The Irish contingent.
Andrew Vincent, yes. Irishman is here. Well, actually, as we always raise that way, that we are Americans. Irish descent, but we're Americans.
Yeah, there you go. And we have a guest coming on, hopefully, tonight. Brendan Moynihan, Next Time Will Be Different is his book, and we'll see if we can. He was supposed to call in, hasn't called in yet. I don't know if Noah has him on the line yet. It's ringing. So.
With faith in the Irish.
Hey, you know, is that what he is, Moynihan? Yeah?
It's not Italian.
Sure. Moynihan, no.
I'm sure of that.
No. Yeah. Okay. No. So anyway, you know, again, if we do interview Brendan, it would be because of the concept that we talk about a lot. You know, and I struggle with a lot of people like to be an investor, but very few people spend time on studying the history of finances, studying the history of markets and so forth. And that's another issue that we have with Brendan Moynihan we're going to be talking about is the history of panics, manias, and crises, you know. And so... you know, it's important to understand what made markets go into a panic in 1807. What made the market crash in 1929? What made the 1907 panic, you know, when I think that's the one where J.P. Morgan basically bailed out the country, you know.
Right, before the Fed was there.
Yeah, and you know, what is that all about and so forth?
Sure, in 1987, okay, that when the market crashed, well, that was kind of the bottom.
Right, yeah. You know, and what
but you thought people thought the world was ending.
You need to understand those things, but, you know, what Brendan's going to teach us is it's all going to be different the next time anyway. So
sure.
Anyway, our guest is with us now, right, Noah? All right, he's on the line.
Great.
Chris, you want to tell us who he is?
Well,
or do you have it or do I have it?
You have it there, but
I'll tell
Brendan
you
Moynihan
quick.
Has written a few books, and we've looked at them, and we especially enjoyed this one. So tell us what the book says. On the
it
jacket
says
there.
He's a managing director of market and media research at Marketfield. And he's a senior advisor to the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News and adjunct professor at the Owen Graduate School of Management at Vanderbilt University. Now, I could go on here for a little while, but that's enough. What do you think, Brendan? Is that enough?
Yeah, for the minute, I think that's fine.
Hey, we really appreciate you coming on with us, and we wanted to address, well, I mean, you know, you had a couple books we'd like to have talked about, but the one we basically studied is Next Time Will Be Different. But we love the book that you wrote that we read, What I Learned Losing $1 Million.
Yeah. Well, there was a co-author involved, so I like to start off with, because he's the one who lost the money, not me.
Right.
We just wrote the book trying to make a fortune off of his misfortune. So
what did you learn? I mean, you know, how can we leave a line like that out without getting an answer? What did you learn?
Well, the real thing is that, I had a theory about the mistakes that traders and investors make. And we wrote the book 20 years ago. And he had a very flowery story in terms of he lost 1.6 out of the 1.2 million that he had in 75 days back in the early 1980s when $1 million was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. He lost 1.6 out of 1.2.
Yeah, do a little bit of quick math and he's down $400,000. So.
Right. He likes leverage.
Yeah, he was on the board, he was on the executive committee at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and then I wound up years and years after that event for him working for him. And like I say, I had a theory about the mistakes that I was making, not losing that kind of money, but whenever I was trading and losing money, I kind of boiled it down to three mistakes. And then when he and I sat and I found out his full story, we decided to go ahead and put it together because his story was too flowery by itself.
Okay.
To sell as a book.
So what are the three?
Well, basically, we kind of backed into it, and it's, I think it's basically the psychological mistakes. Mm-hmm. And if you look up the word psychology in the dictionary, which I didn't do until after I was well into the book, but it's basically the mental processes, behavioral characteristics, and emotions of a group or individual. So the mental processes that people go through when they're losing are they basically personalize what should be an impersonal or external loss. Like when you lose your keys, you don't really call yourself dummy, right? But when we lose money in the market, because we lose points on tests, we think we must be wrong, and we start to confuse right and wrong with making money and losing money. We confuse self-worth and net worth.
Huh.
So people go through five stages of internal loss, and it comes from a book of, it was an interview book of 200 people who have terminal illness, and they go through denial, then anger, then bargaining, then depression, then acceptance. And once you start falling into that trap, if you're in a position you're losing money and you find yourself going through those, boom, that's mistake number one. You've internalized what should be an external loss. The other thing, so that's the mental process. The behavioral characteristics are people confuse the five different types of market participants there are. I think there are investors, traders, speculators, bettors, people who just want to be right. They don't care about the money. And then gamblers, which, you know, is a disease, and I can't really address it fully. But just because you're participating in the financial markets doesn't absolve you from betting or gambling. If you exhibit certain behavioral characteristics, you're really more interested in being right, or you're there for the adrenaline rush than you are for one of those other three types of activity. So then the last part of the definition is the emotions. And emotions are neither good nor bad. They simply are. But emotional decision-making is bad. And so I sort of boiled down that when a psychological crowd forms, people in that crowd will do things that are obviously negative for their self-interest. But because they get to hide in the crowd, they'll do it. This is, you know, people after a city wins a football national championship, they go out and, you know, burn police cars and do whatever. I mean, it's insane, right?
Right.
But when they're in a crowd, they'll do that. I think that an individual can, by himself or herself sitting in front of a screen, engage in sorts of crowd behavior with their investments and trading decisions. And if you exhibit those attributes, then you're basically making emotional decision making, and so that's the sort of Reader's Digest version of it. And then, you know, I take 65,000 words to kind of go through all of it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, but the book we wanted to talk about tonight, and that you actually, what you just described, leads it right into this. Next time
sure.
will be different,
yep.
And why economists can't predict financial panics and crises. And, you know, basically, you know, I've only got about 30 seconds to a minute before I've got to take a pause and do traffic. But, you know, the way I interpret this book is that economists can look at what's happened and try to predict what they should do to make things better for the future. But what you're saying in here is it's not going to work.
Correct. They're like weathermen. They're tenured. They can predict to be wrong, and they still get to keep their jobs.
Well, that's a good way to end this first segment, and then we'll come back and talk more about that. Hold on with me, Brendan. Right now, we're going to go find out what's happening with traffic and Maggie Hunter, and we're going to be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're back with Brendan Moynihan. We're talking about his book, Next Time Will Be Different, and Why Economists Can't Predict Financial Panics and Crises. And Brendan, one of the things that I was talking about when we first started the show is that I'm shocked at how many investors invest and yet don't study history. And you give an incredible recap of all the different panics and crises and manias from 1800 to 2013 or 2012. And I was amazed at how many panics there were between 1792, I think it says in your book,
yeah.
all the way
yeah,
up to
thing.
1933.
Yeah, well, and really what I did was I really did focus on the downside. I mean, there are other books out there that talk about the manias and the things that caused the booms. I mean, similar to the other title, which was sort of, you know, a bit of a downer if you think about it, right?
Right.
I was really only interested in looking at the downside of things and say that what happened in 2008 is one, not new, two, is not predictable by the quote-unquote sciences that are, you know, presented to us. And there were many episodes of panics and crises, and there's a distinction between the two of them, starting in 1792, which is, you know, the first year the New York Stock Exchange opened for business. And it was sort of a nice way to introduce the market to the world, to Americans anyway, and, to have a 25% crash in securities prices, so.
So they all know what the markets are all about then.
Well, you know, it's that I think that's the thing is that, you know, the title of the book is obviously a shot across the bow of another book that gained some prominence by a couple of tenured economists here in the last few years. But I noticed two things about their book. One, it came out after the financial crisis, so I'm sort of like, well, you know, so how useful is this?
Sure.
And their subtitle was, you know, 8 centuries of financial folly, in which they plan to be able to go back 800 years and collect data to see and say, here's, we've been here before. This has happened repeatedly over 800 years, blah, 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 blah. Well, in my mind, the data, if you look at it, the data is really not that good going back before 1946 in the United States. And this is probably the one place in the world where the data is probably the best and cleanest. And it's not very good even here going from 1946 back to 1800, but they claim by, you know, going through the documents they did that for 800 years they have, you know, quote unquote reliable data to use. Again, I noticed that they came out with their book after the crisis, not before it. I also think that lumping together that large a swath of history is misleading. You know, the half of mine is called their, the economists are kind of living in Lake Wobegon, you know, where they think that everybody is above average. They love averages. You know, the last time this happened, they don't say the last time this happened. They'll say the last 11 times this happened, or since, you know, we've had 11 recessions since World War II, and they'll say what the average growth rate is after that for so many months. They average everything. They just massage the data down, and they completely missed the nuance that goes on in each one of these different cycles. And the two biggest lines of demarcation are just, you know, from 1933, when we came off the gold standard in the U.S., when Roosevelt abrogated the gold contracts he had with people who had invested in U.S. government securities that were gold-backed, and then he said, we're not going to pay you back in gold. We were in a metallic money era prior to that. So from 1792 up until then, we basically had a metallic money-based system in the United States, which is subject to laws being changed, such as what is the legal ratio between gold and silver in circulating in the economy, to saying silver is no longer legal tender in the economy, to foreign coins used to circulate in the United States until 1857. Congress came out and said, nope, you can't have foreign coins circulating as legal tender in the United States anymore. Boom, you have a contraction in the money supply, and you wind up with a crisis in the wake of it. But to meld those with a purely paper money era, which started in 1971 in the United States, and average all that 200-year span or 225-year span together, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense when you're operating with completely different kinds of monetary regimes in the economy. And
I think, Brendan, this is Chris, for people to try to understand it, they look back and say, okay, it's hard to... You know, we look at these things and we get excited about talking about the span of time, whether it's back to 1792 or even going back and thinking of the different manias and crises. But for people looking at even today, something they live through, they've heard, you know, time and time again about how the 2008 and succeeding years were the worst economic times since the Great Depression. And your book points out that, well, on several fronts, no, it wasn't. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's, and, you know, part of this is the media, right? I mean, they, a journalist catches hold of something or a stray comment from an analyst who hasn't done his or her homework and finds out that GDP was actually, you know, had a worse stretch in 1957. People forget, for whatever reason, that the first quarter of 1980, Jimmy Carter went on television and told people to stop using their credit cards because it was causing inflation. A bunch of Americans took their credit cards, cut them up, and mailed them 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and GDP contracted 10.1% the first quarter of 1980.
Wow.
Right? It didn't do that in this past recession. All right. So, no, I agree. And you know, let's take it further. During the Depression, which, you know, when do you want to mark the beginning of that? Most people take it to 1929 when the stock market crashed, but the first banks didn't fail until November 1930, so you really didn't have a depression going on. You had a stock market crash. They weren't even calculating GDP at the time. It became an exercise mandated in 1932 or 1933 when, you know, the government wanted academics to come up with some sort of gauge to find out what was going on with the economy, and they started kind of calculating it then, and they backfitted all the data. Seems like the S&P 500.
Well, you know,
people say, well, the S&P 500 has returned, you know, on average, X percent a year since 1926 and blah, 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 blah. The S&P 500 didn't exist in 1926. It was March 4th, 1957. Before that, it was a 90-stock index, okay? So people, you know, they hear that, they accept it, they believe it, but sometimes you have to lift the hood and unpack the data to try to find out what's, you know, really going on.
Now, what's interesting about your book is you say, why economists can't predict financial panics and crises. And it's only logical because human beings are involved in the markets and in the economy, and human beings aren't always perfectly rational. Why would you expect them to figure this out?
Well, yeah, the personal pronoun there is the operative one, right? I don't. I think everybody else does, right? Economists have an inferiority complex. They desperately want to be seen as natural scientists. So after World War II, they began to introduce econometrics and a lot of math and a lot of Greek letters to what they do in an attempt to try to model and predict human behavior. And they have failed miserably. And, you know, if, like I say, if you remove the tenures system for them, they wouldn't have jobs, okay? Because right now they get to be wrong and they get to keep their jobs. But if they didn't have that and they had to start at zero every day, they would never make it because they are unable to predict and forecast. Not only are people irrational, but even when they're rational, the incentive structures change over time. What made sense to do 20 years ago is different now. And so, no, I don't think you can model human behavior on that big, grand a scale, but they get to do that, and because they're tenured. I mean, I've got a friend who says, you know, he told me, he said, there are two dirty little secrets about business school. I'm not going to tell you his name because he's a tenured professor. Because one, we really don't know that much about business and how it works. And two, we spend all of our time answering questions that nobody asks. So if that's even a glimpse inside, you know, what's going on in academia, it's revealing. But again, they cannot predict. I mean, it's a social science. You're trying to study people. And it's not moving heavenly bodies where you can predict what the pattern is going to be and what the motion is going to be. If it were a full-blown, really accurate science with any kind of predictive value, you wouldn't have disagreements among the major players in that field about just common knowledge in the field. And yet, they do disagree.
You have right. Yeah, I love the
government.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I love the quote that you put in there from Jim Grant, who talked about, well, if everyone was so smart, then nobody would be on the losing side of a trade. You know, if they were able to predict the future. Essentially, that's what he said.
If the socialists were right, if the future were perfectly predictable, nobody would ever take the losing side of a trade. I think that's what the quote is.
Yes, right.
Well, Brendan, you got to hold on for us for 1 second. And the thing that I wanted to jump into in the second part of this show is that if what we just said is true about economists, and I believe it is, and I think you do, we've got a bunch of economists who are making kind of, you know, they're out in a zone of doing things in the central banks of the world that are totally different and new, and it only gives precedence to what you're saying is next time is going to be pretty different, and we wanted to get your idea of how different do you think it's going to be, and
okay,
so forth. But right now we got to go to Maggie Hunter and traffic, and we'll be right back from this pause with Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We've got Brendan Moynihan with us. We're talking about his book, Next Time Will Be Different. And Brendan, before we jump into now, you know, one fascinating part of your book is you mentioned between World War II and 1971, there's no financial crises during that 25-year period of time. What would you attribute that to?
Well, it was government control of capital in and out of the country is the primary reason. You did not. You had capital controls instituted after World War II, and you had a fixed currency regime in the world. You basically had gold exchangeable to the dollar at $35 an ounce, and then other currencies in the world were basically pegged to the U.S. dollar. So you didn't have pressure points in international trade that would create potential problems or tensions in individual currencies, because the currencies were pegged and there were capital controls that really prevented capital from flowing freely from one part of the world to the other.
So what made them leave that system?
Well, it was the two wars that the United States was engaged in 1960. One was a domestic war on poverty, and the second was a police action, as it was termed
in Vietnam.
When the government here basically just printed dollars to pay for the ever-rising cost of both of those wars. So the rest of the world for a while stood idly by and saw the increased number of dollars being created in the printing presses in the United States. And they had the ability to take those, as they received those dollars, if they didn't trust them, they could turn them in and get gold. U.S. citizens could not. It was illegal for U.S. citizens to hold gold from 1934 until December 31st, 1974, to get old small bits of jewelry, but you could not own gold as an investment or gold coins or gold bullion. So foreign central banks were basically coming to the U.S. and turning in all those excess dollars and taking gold. So gold was being drained out of the United States. And finally, the United States decided they weren't going to do it anymore. And on August 15th, 1971, Richard Nixon came out and said, we're going to slam the gold window shut. We're no longer going to exchange our dollars for gold. Well, September 9th, a few weeks later, OPEC comes out and says, because of that move, we are going to retain our purchasing power in the dollar, so we're going to raise the price of oil. They understood what the ramifications were of all that printed money floating around out there, and it worked as long as everybody believed in the system. But we printed so many dollars that it overwhelmed the confidence that foreign central banks and foreign investors had in the U.S., and so they put a severe strain on the gold flow out of the United States, and the United States said, we're not going to do it anymore, and so, boom, that was the beginning of the inflationary environment.
So then after that, Brendan, then all of a sudden we start going into all these crises again, you know, crises of the OPEC thing, and,
right,
you know, the inflation. And then we go to the crash of 87, and then the SNL crises, and, you know, and don't forget the money center banks in 1980. That was a doozy. And the government is reactionary. It jumps in and says, oh, we're going to bail this out. We're not going to let this fail. We're not going to let that fail. And that continues on all the way up to 2008, basically.
Yes. And then so there were sort of two changes, I think, that took place in 2008. If you were to plot, which the book has a chart, I know you've seen it, the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield on the chart, and then you noted where those financial crises happened post-1971, starting with Lockheed.
Right.
You'll notice a peak in those rates and then a big drop. You'll see a big drop in Fed funds rates as well, because the Fed comes in and says, we're going to ease monetary conditions. The rising interest rate environment has caused stress in each of those episodes going back, caused stress on people who had borrowed money. If you go back through, you know, history, if you want to go back through the 8 centuries of financial folly that the two, you know, professors claim to have been able to gone through, crises weren't really an issue until you had credit in the system. That was really the 17th century. Borrowed money is what the problem is.
Sure.
So rising interest rates shows what the problem is. Warren Buffett's line is, you know, it's only when the tide goes out that you find out who's swimming without their trunks on, okay? Well, rising interest rates do that. And so when it's applied severe pressure in the economy and there's a failure or a bank or a big company goes, then the Fed comes in and starts easing interest rates and takes other measures to try to ameliorate the situation. But in 2008, it took a little bit of a different turn. And it has definitely changed the landscape, I think, for going forward on two fronts. One, the Fed has taken its interest rate to zero as of December 2008. So basically it has removed the one tool that it has in the past used to try to ameliorate the situation in the money markets in the United States. Second thing is that the United States government went into AIG after Lehman failed and said, we are not going to wait for you to tell us there's a problem. We're going to take over 79.9% of your company, period. The next month, they went into the 10 largest banks in the United States and said, they brought those CEOs in and said, we put a piece of paper in front of you. We're going to invest between $10 and $25 billion in each one of your banks to try to liquefy things. You will sign that piece of paper before you leave here. And if you don't think you're going to, look out at the other end of the table because your regulator is down there taking names. Okay?
Now, you know, that was one of the greatest insider trading things I've ever seen in my entire life, was when they forced the banks to sell stock to them because they knew they were going to make money on it in the future.
Well, and to me, it was the preemptive measure that did it. And then the government didn't stop there. They went to GM and they basically, you know, breached the sanctity of the bond covenant in a private company by saying, we're going to put you through a prepackaged bankruptcy and the bondholders are going to take a haircut on this. And, you know, we can do it because we're the government and we can put you in jail or we can do whatever we want. In the end, that's basically what it was. It has set a completely different pattern. And what's going to make this next one different is the combination of that predisposition to preemptively move and the fact that the Fed now has a completely different monetary toolbox at its fingertips. By that I mean this. The Fed used to, you know, for 100 years of its existence, the law was passed Christmas Eve, 1913. They had their first meeting in 1914. You had World War One, blah, blah. They're 100 years old today, okay? They used to manipulate the overnight interest rate between banks to try to stimulate lending and get the economy going again when things were slow and try to curtail lending and curtail inflation when things were running kind of hot in the economy. It was a very precision tool instrument. Doesn't necessarily mean that it was perfect or worked exactly like a clock every time they wanted it to do it. But it was a very narrow, precise tool for trying to exert influence over spending in the economy, borrowing and spending in the economy, okay? The Fed used to also be the lender of last resort, the function of a central bank, that when there are stresses in the system, that they will lend money to banks, and the banks turn over good performing loans to the central bank in exchange for those loans, so that the banks have money for the depositors who are coming in and saying, we want our money back, we want our money back, we want our money back. So at least they can keep the system liquid. But those are loans. The central bank was always the lender of last resort. In the last crisis, the Federal Reserve became the buyer of last resort. They took their balance sheet from $800 billion before the crisis to $4.5 trillion now. And when they did that, when in the course of buying all of those securities, they basically did this. They decamped from the banking system, which is where they used to exert influence using the interbank overnight interest rate, the Fed funds rate. And they purchased those bonds, which basically gave the money to the people who owned those bonds, and they have no way of taking it back out of the system. They've launched a missile that they cannot recall. It is gone. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 trillion is out there in the system now that the Fed cannot excise out of the system the way it could when it's operated in the overnight interest rate market.
That's a great point.
Now it's operating in the capital market, and that money is just sloshing around out there, and it has no way to recall it.
All right.
An experiment going in is going to be an experiment coming out.
All right, you got to hold on. We're going to come back for our last segment, but right now I'm going to pause for Mark Thibodeau on the Weather Channel, and then I'll be right back, and we're going to get into, okay, where do we go from here? So far you've set a gloomy future, but we'll see if we can get some sunshine out of this. Anyway, Mark Thibodeau, take it away.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're here with Brendan Moynihan. We're talking about his book, Next Time Will Be Different, great history of financial panics and so forth, and why economists can't predict financial panics and crises or prevent them. So don't expect them to, but yet they're trying to, and they're doing a lot of weird things in the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world. And so You know, I guess, Brendan, you got two things going on that you just told us. You say, number one, they've become the buyer of last resort, and they put $3.5 trillion that they're not going to be able to get back, and that's an issue. And the other thing you said is that when interest rates rise, you get to see who who's swimming without their trunks on. And the question, can the federal government or the central banks of the world keep interest rates at zero, or will the markets one day rebel that interest rates will rise and they're out of control and you really have a doozy of a financial mess on your hand?
Right. And let me, I'm going to interject this just for grins. Because as we start talking about the possibilities, we've been talking about history, and it's fine to talk about history. Talk about going forward, it's important for me to say that none of my employers, like, endorse any of the book writing I do. I write the books for a hobby. It's not connected to my work directly, and nobody endorses it. I just think it's important for that to be out there.
Sure.
Talking about history, it's not a problem. Talking about going forward, I just want to make sure everybody's clear. So I would say that, yeah, the central banks collectively, in the last 5 years, global central banks have put about about $20 trillion into the respective economies. You now have the major central banks of the world, which in the past used to be noted for being inflation fighters. They had an inflation target, but it was always a ceiling. Now you have central banks, and all they're talking about is an inflation floor. It's got to be 2%. It's got to be 2%, at least 2%. They want inflation. They're probably going to get it. They have provided the fodder out there for it to happen. You're right about, will the market rebel? The bond market, there's a point at which the bond market will start to whiff the inflation theme and be concerned about the fact that they have printed all this money to buy securities, and then those rates will start to rise. If the Fed tries to slow the economy down, basically the tool it has is that $3.5 trillion worth of bonds. So if it starts selling those into the market to try to raise interest rates to slow things down or squelch inflation, all they're going to do is exacerbate the rise in interest rates. The connection to there are two other points I want to make. One is you're talking about the economists and the forecast and all the rest. The Federal Reserve in D.C. has 200 PhDs on staff, okay, PhD economists, and not a single banker. Not a single banker in that staff who's extended a loan or denied a loan to somebody. All they are is econometricians who are manipulating mathematical models, trying to predict what's going to happen. To me, a little bit of a dicey thing. I'd rather have at least some bankers out there who understand and know what's going on. The other thing is, in the event that you do get a crisis of some sort, it could emanate from Russia. It could, you know, I'm not predicting where it comes from, right? Because I don't know either. It's like, if I knew, I'd be on an island in the South Pacific somewhere, drinking a little drink with a little bamboo umbrella in it, right? You know, and because I know this stuff and I'd be rich. But
right.
If you get one, if another one comes along, this will be the first time since probably the mid-1600s that it's happened where there's just been too much money around. In the past, these episodes have been a function of stringency or constraint in money, whether it was an emerging market that got caught crosswise with rising interest rates and their currency being devalued, and then their debt load exploding because of they had borrowed not in their own currency, they borrowed from somewhere else, and they didn't have enough money to pay it back. All of those were stringent, constraining things. In the event that you get another spasm or some sort of crisis here over the next few years because the central banks have put so much money in the system, it'll be the first time in, you know, the better part of 400 years that it's happened where there's been too much money around. And that is going to be a difference from all the previous episodes that people have been looking at here recently to say, can we use that as a guidepost? What's going to happen? It will raise issues and problems that people had not even thought to think about because they're failing to take into account how unusual this experiment has been by the central banks.
Well, you also have the situation that you could have a deflationary bust before you get this the next run like you're talking about.
But I don't see where it would happen. But with all the money that's being printed and put out, I mean, again, $20 trillion in the last 5 years, you now have the four major central bank regions of the world with their foot to the accelerator. The ECB just joined the bandwagon a couple of weeks ago. You have Brazil and China now, after several years of trying to constrain their economies, turning tail and starting to try to inflate things a bit. And something else that people, you know, there is $2 trillion worth of spending power sitting on balance sheets at U.S. corporations that was not there in the last crisis. That money is there, which can go pay up for any kind of, I mean, if things start getting out of hand and they see the inflationary, you know, cycle starting to turn, they've got plenty of money that the central bank has no control over. That's another $2 trillion in the U.S. economy that can go after it.
So how do you explain the collapse in the velocity of money?
Well, see, deflation, so here's the thing. Deflation is misinterpreted. It has two meanings. One, if there's a general decline in the prices because of increased productivity or because of increased supply, that is not a deleterious thing to the economy necessarily, because there are going to be benefactors, there are people who will benefit from that. Deflation from debt extinguishment or debt write-downs, that's the problem, and that's what we experienced in the 1930s. That's not really the issue right now. That's not what is kind of keeping things tamped down in terms of rising prices at a macro level. You take the average of the whole economy. But if you look, especially in the United States, in individual pockets of the economy, you will see that there are already inflationary dislocations taking place in certain industries and certain pockets of the U.S. economy.
So no doubt.
Part of the trend of loss of the money is that the banks are basically being told by the governments around the world, particularly the U.S. and particularly in Europe, you are bad actors. The Treasury said 3 weeks ago, if you guys can't behave better, we're going to break you up. Okay, no bank wants to lend money to anybody if that's the case. All they're going to do is park it in whatever fixed-income instrument they can get their hands on. They're not interested in lending, not interested in having a problem. They're not interested in going to jail. And that is what the message has been from the regulators in the United States and Europe for the past 4 years. It's been politically correct to kick bankers.
Well, I like to say, they saved the banks just to beat them, you know, bludgeon them dead. You know?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm going to leave you with one. Here's the thing to think about, just on an interesting, ironic note. Okay. Probably the best thing that happened in the U.S. was that Ben Bernanke, who was a student of the Great Depression, knew the importance of saving the banking system in the United States. No matter how distasteful it was for people who got bonuses or whatever, doesn't matter. The fact is, he was the right person because he understood what it meant to the economy, okay? He's no longer Fed chairman. 2 weeks ago, he tried to get a refinance on his house, and he was turned down. He said it in a speech. He said, I could not refinance my house. It's not a $10 million house. He doesn't have W-2 income, so he is immediately disqualified from refinancing his house because he doesn't have W-2 income.
Man.
Now, that is something for politicians to start to think about.
Yeah. Brendan, what a great conversation. I think we could have done it for another hour, but neither of us have the time. We really appreciate you being with us.
Great. Thanks.
It's Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.